WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. Those words from the Declaration of Independence of July 4, 1776 called for an uprising against a tyrannical government. This more than 200-year-old call to revolution will be celebrated in a few days with more patriotic fervor than usual. The very officials leading the patriotic cheerleading will be the ones that put into place the USA Patriot Act that makes a modern person, echoing Thomas Jefferson's historic call to action, a terrorist. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're going to hear a panel discussion titled Liberty versus Security on the subject of the so-called USA Patriot Act that many regard as legislation that officially initiated a government as oppressive, if not more so, than the one that inspired the 1776 Declaration.
I don't know, good horse, as we trot in this dark here.
This panel discussion was held on March 21, 2002, in Willimantic, Connecticut. It was sponsored by the Northeast Connecticut Green Party. The event was a public forum on the state of civil liberties in the wake of the USA Patriot Act and the ongoing war on terrorism. Speakers were asked to address these issues as they relate to constitutional rights and their effects on Latino immigrants, Arab Americans, and social justice activists.
My name is Donna Nicolino, and I'm a member of the Northeast Connecticut Green Party, which is sponsoring this forum. And the name of this forum is Liberty versus Security. How has the war on terrorism affected our civil liberties? Each of our panelists tonight will explore a different aspect of that question. The issues that are going to be brought up this evening are not going to go away overnight. It will take the concerted effort of many people. Since September 11th, up to 2,000 Arab American men have been detained and even deported, often without any kind of due process or being able to contact their families or a lawyer. This situation has gotten so bad that the British newspaper, the UK Independent, has likened the detentions to the practice of disappearing people in Latin America. Congress has passed the USA Patriot Act, most of them without actually having read it, which jeopardizes many of the rights we thought were guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. And Attorney General John Ashcroft has stated that to even question these actions is to give comfort to the enemy. However, one could easily disagree and say that one of the most important roles of a citizen in a true democracy is to ask questions and hold our representatives accountable. In fact, as abolitionist Wendell Phillips once said, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Hopefully this forum will help answer some of the questions you have, and hopefully it will raise even more. And our first speaker is going to be Azam Saeed. Azam is a former Air Force pilot from Pakistan and is now a U.S. citizen. He has held management positions in Europe as well as the United States with a number of multinational corporations. His education is in physics, and he also holds a master's degree in business administration from the University of Michigan Business School. His civic work has been with organizations such as Amnesty International and UNICEF. Four of the world's largest religions are represented within his immediate family. He lives in Farmington with his wife, Dr. Aisha Saeed.
Thank you, Donna, for that kind introduction. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here this evening. I should first of all mention the reason I'm here. When Donna called me and requested me to speak here, I said, on this subject, Donna, do you realize that I tend to be a Republican voting conservative, and I actually voted for George Bush in 2000. Donna said, hey, don't worry about that. We'll call you an activist, and all your sins will be forgiven. So I'm really here for redemption. And Donna has asked me to talk about this subject from two angles. One is the balance between security and liberty, and the second one is the international angle to this situation and crisis we face, especially in regards to the U.S. foreign policy. There are two handouts I have I should just point out. I'll try to cover some of this information, but one is about who created Al-Qaeda, why and how, words of Zbigniew Brzezinski and Professor Iqbal Ahmed, just a one-sheet handout. And the second thing I have to understand how things function in our world is once again, a one-sheet ABC News report about something called Operation Northwoods. And so for those of you who have not heard about Operation Northwoods, I would strongly recommend that you take a copy of this, and it gives a very good picture of how things work, even in countries or societies called democratic otherwise. Let me begin using the words of William Douglas, U.S. Supreme Court Justice from 1939 to 1975. Quote, as nightfall does not come at once, neither does oppression. There is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged, and it is in such a twilight that we must be most aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness, end quote. Having lived under three martial law regimes, even at the risk of sounding arrogant, I would say that I have a fairly good idea of what Justice Douglas is talking about. The debate in our media about enhancing security within the United States hovers around the model that liberty and security are mutually exclusive, and we need to give up some liberty to get some more security. It seems that the only question to ask is, how much liberty need we give up to become more secure? What has not been highlighted in the media is the viewpoint that the two, that is security and liberty, are not mutually exclusive. They certainly do not have an inverse mutual relationship on the same dimension. Benjamin Franklin conveyed the point clearly, quote, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety, end quote. Another point our media has conveniently ignored is that the current paradigm is regressive and falls flat on its face if taken a couple of steps further. What if there is another terrorist attack on the U.S. soil? Would we give up some more liberty then? What if there is yet another attack despite giving up even more liberties? Would we then be willing to live in a police state? Many experts are very emphatic on this subject. Frank Anderson, the former head of CIA's Middle East operations, was questioned by Mike Wallace sometime in November, I believe, in a 60 Minutes broadcast about how much civil liberty we need to give up. Anderson did not mince his words. Quote, absolutely none. If we cannot handle this problem without surrendering our civil liberties, our constitutional freedoms, then I do not want to live in this country. End quote. Now, I'm sure other speakers will talk about the secrecy surrounding the detentions and all of the proceedings that are going on in this country vis-a-vis people who have been detained or arrested. I would like to talk about secrecy from a different angle, and that is the angle of policy in terms of what has been conveyed to the people about why things are the way they are from a very broad perspective. And we should realize that all of the secrecy accompanying this situation also has an implication for our democratic maxim that ours is a government of the people, for the people, by the people. How dear do we hold this maxim, and even what do we mean by democracy is the question. Abraham Lincoln enunciated the philosophical foundation of our concept of democracy succinctly. Quote, "I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts." End quote. So, in order to neutralize the threats we face internally and externally, we need to understand them a little more deeply. And we should try to figure out how such threats come into being. Let's ask ourselves the question, who created Al-Qaeda? And my experience has been that 99% of the people in this country would not be able to answer that question adequately or accurately at all. The answer may be disturbing and even depressing to most, but finally knowing the truth is a liberating experience. And my hope for this evening is that all of us here would know who created Al-Qaeda by the end of this session. This knowledge may finally lead us to realize what the rest of the world has been trying to tell us for a long time about our own foreign policy. Thus, information about what's going on and what the government has found out is an essential part of our national decision-making process. It may be worth reminding ourselves that secrecy is antithesis to democracy, and the excuse of national security is often just that, an excuse. In November 2001, President George Bush signed an executive order that allows either a sitting or past president to block access to White House papers. This order reverses a 1978 law emanating from the Watergate scandal, which allowed U.S. citizens access to presidential papers 12 years after the term of office finished. In a piece in the Christian Science Monitor, Pat Holt, former chief of staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, elaborated, quote, "Some of these new executive orders have nothing to do with terrorism. An example is assertion of a presidential right to overrule both Congress and prior presidents to prevent the release of presidential papers. President Bush argues non-existent constitutional powers, a thin and insupportable ground, nor is there any reason. One therefore has to look for hidden reasons." End quote. 100 Nobel laureates made a statement a few months ago, three months ago, that was largely ignored by our mainstream media. Among other things, it said the following, quote, "It is time to turn our backs on the unilateral search for security in which we seek to shelter behind walls. To survive in the world we have transformed, we must learn to think in a new way." End quote. And when we start thinking in a new way, the types of questions we should begin with would be the following, in my viewpoint. Why 9/11? Why did it happen? Why is it that 99% of people in this country do not have a good idea of who created Al-Qaeda? Why is it that 99% of this people in this country do not realize to an adequate extent what all goes on in our name all over the world? And when we answer those questions, we will come to another link that is crucial, and that is the role of our mainstream media in the way things work. And so when we try to answer these questions, we should also look at the role and realize how our mainstream media plays a role in keeping us unaware and innocent. To conclude, the economic and political power play in the world is a complex phenomenon. It is not a battle between good and evil, and it is certainly not a battle where any one side is consistently on the side of good. Developing some understanding of this complexity would go a long way in our ability to be secure and simultaneously retain our abilities. When we look around the globe, we realize that the world's history has not seen a nation stronger than the United States, militarily or economically. It may also be worth noting that a strong and honorable democratic nation faces no threat to its security and liberty more serious than its own collective innocence and unawareness. Do I have a couple more minutes? Two more minutes? I'll quickly go over, and I could go into more details if need be, but here's what Professor Iqbal Ahmed has to say about who created Al-Qaeda. Late Iqbal Ahmed said all of this, most of this, in a lecture he delivered in 1998, so prophetic and prescient words. And he was from Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He died in 1999. Quote, "What happened in Afghanistan has not been discussed in the West. When the Soviet Union intervened in Afghanistan, the U.S. saw it as an opportunity that was twofold. One, they hoped to tie up the Soviet Union in a Vietnam-like war in Afghanistan itself. Two, which becomes more important later on, they saw an opportunity to mobilize the entire Muslim world in a violent way against the Soviet Union, against communism. In an effort to mobilize the entire Muslim world against the evil empire, the CIA started supporting the flow of volunteers from all around the world to fight in Afghanistan, to be socialized into the ideology of anti-communism, and to be trained to hit communists wherever they found them. That's how the militants were recruited and flown in. I've seen plane loads of them arriving from Algeria, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, even from Palestine, where at that time Israel was supporting Hamas against al-Fatah, Yasser Arafat's faction of the PLO. These people were brought in, given an ideology, and told that armed struggle is virtuous, and the whole notion of jihad as an international pan-Islamic movement was born. The U.S. has spent billions in producing the bin Ladens of our time. In 1986, I visited the camp they hit in Zawahar, Afghanistan, in 1998. It was a CIA-sponsored camp. The United States did not withdraw their support from bin Laden and others. They continued their support. I have some more. If there are questions, I'll go into more details. Thank you.
You were listening to a panel discussion on civil liberties following the September 11th calamity. The event took place in Willimantic, Connecticut on March 21st, 2002.
Our next speaker is Teresa Younger. Teresa Younger is the executive director of the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union. She is the first woman and African-American executive director in the 50-plus years of the CCLU. Teresa is not a lawyer, but comes to the CCLU with nearly 10 years' experience in nonprofit management, youth development, program development, and fundraising. Prior to joining the CCLU, Teresa was employed with Changing Our World Incorporated, a philanthropic services consulting firm headquartered in New York City. Teresa's past work and personal experiences assist her in her quest to lead the CCLU and its nearly 5,000 statewide members into the next round of battles to preserve individual civil liberties and actively defend the freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Thank you very much. I think it's important to read my bio because I think people's perception of the ACLU is that it's a whole bunch of left-wingers or that it's a whole bunch of lawyers. And oftentimes, members of the ACLU are the common everyday citizen who are passionately concerned about preserving the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States. And so it's with much enjoyment that I accepted this position 8 months ago. And little did I know when I accepted the position, the state of the world we would be in today. So I walked into it as an activist on many levels, but had no concept what we would be facing politically, nationally, and here in Connecticut. I think it's important as we move forward, I'm going to be speaking on some of the concerns around the USA Patriot Bill. I want to point out a couple of things. I want to let you know again what is said in the Bill of Rights, because I think we get the lesson in eighth grade, if we still get the lesson anymore in eighth grade, and then we almost forget about it, and then somebody might bring it up in way. But the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of press or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's the First Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, homes, papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause supported by oath and affirmation, and particularly describing the place of to be searched and the person and things to be seized. I want to just mention one more of these wonderful Bill of Rights that we have here that were put together. Little did they know now then what we were in now. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously asserted by law, and to be informed by the nature and cause of accusations, can be confirmed with a witness against him, can have compulsory process for obtaining witness of his favor, and have assistance of counsel for his defense. That being said, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the USA Patriot Bill. Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU National Office, said, terror by its very nature is intended to not only kill and destroy. Terror is also designed to intimidate the people and force them to take actions that may Terror is designed to intimidate a people and force them to take actions that may not be in their long-term best interests. If we allow our freedoms to be undermined, the terrorists will have won. Briefly after September 11th, many of you will recall that Congress got together and put together a piece of legislation called the USA Patriot Bill. The formal title of this bill is called Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. Quite a title. And in 6 weeks, they got that together. In 6 weeks, they got it together, and people, majority of the people in those rooms, agreed that this was a good bill. And we should note a little bit of the history of the bill. The USA Patriot Bill, portions of that bill had been introduced to Congress time and time and time again and had been turned away as being too draconian. They said, no, we won't even bring it up for discussion. Yet, on September 13th, when discussion around the USA Patriot Bill began behind closed doors, it was introduced again, pulled off the shelf, dusted off, and reintroduced as absolutely needed by the Congress in order to protect the American people. This is an attempt, and it's happened in the past, where government doesn't inform the people fully but takes action in their best interest. Historically, we've overreacted and violated constitutional principles. We don't have to go back so far, but we all do this in the guise of national security. We'll recall World War I, when in its aftermath, people were sent to prison for criticizing the war effort. Demonstrators were subjected to the infamous Palmer raids, where labor organizers and dissenters were systematically rounded up and jailed without arraignment, hearings, or access to attorneys. Just a quick relation. There's a group called the Hartford 18 who were protesting the efforts, who were quickly rounded up, detained, and without counsel, were charged. And now they're in the process of going through that cycle. Interesting. In World War II, we sent 110,000 Japanese Americans to detention camps. Boy, we have something like 2,000 or 3,000 American citizens or longtime residents being detained across this country, and I believe Ashcroft has mentioned he'd like to call in another 3,000 for questioning. The fear of communism created by Senator McCarthy created the Red Scare and guilt by association. Interestingly enough, in 1956, In God We Trust became the motto. It was added to the Pledge of Allegiance and to the oath. God all of a sudden entered into these places because we didn't want to be perceived as a godless constitution, as a godless country. Yet we are seeing in this very state legislation to mandate putting In God We Trust motto signs in every single classroom, mandating on a statewide level that the Pledge of Allegiance be said every day. The Oklahoma bombing resurrected anti-terrorism legislation that had been shelved by Congress as too draconian back then. It became law within 2 weeks of the tragedy and almost completely eliminated the right of habeas corpus. Quickly after the events of September 11th, 6 weeks after the events of September 11th, the USA Patriot Bill was passed. Interestingly enough, 66 representatives voted against the USA Patriot Bill, and one senator voted against the USA Patriot Bill. You almost can't get this majority of people to agree that the sky is blue without about 8 months of debate, and yet we quickly ran in to say that the USA Patriot Bill was needed and necessary. Let me just give you a quick rundown of what some of our concerns are, and then I'll be available to answer some questions. First off, it gives sweeping new powers of detention and surveillance to the executive branch of the government and law enforcement agencies, and depriving the courts of meaningful judicial oversight to ensure that law enforcement powers are not being abused. In fact, warrants can be issued without probable cause, something mentioned in our own Bill of Rights. It gives the Secretary of State the authority to designate any group, foreign or domestic, as a terrorist organization, an authority that is not subject to review. It creates a broad new crime called domestic terrorism, which is defined as, in Section 802 as activities that involves dangerous acts to human life that are in violation of criminal laws of any of the United States or of any state, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, to influence the policy of government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of government by mass destruction, assassination, and kidnapping. This broad definition would include activities that no reasonable person would consider terrorist activities and go so far as to include criminal acts like computer hacking, vandalism, and other low-level crimes. Even the protesters of the AA case, Greenpeace, and PETA could be seen as domestic terrorists. Heaven forbid we consider groups like our own union groups or our own political groups that might have been active during the 1960s. It permits investigations based on lawful First Amendment activity if the activity is tied somehow to intelligence purposes. This bill would permit the FBI to conduct searches and secretly record telephone conversations for the purpose of investigating domestic crime, even if the FBI cannot meet the probable cause standard. It undermines the privacy protections of the Fourth Amendment by eroding the line between intelligence gathering and gathering evidence for criminal proceedings. It expands the ability of the government to spy through wiretaps, computer surveillance, access to medical, financial, business, and educational records, and allows secret searches of homes and offices. These secret searches are called sneak and peek searches and will be done without the knowledge of the person being searched until after the fact. It undermines a fair due process granted by the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments, and extends to non-citizens all over the country. It extends to non-citizens, even though the Supreme Court has ruled that they do not have due process. Non-citizens can be arrested and held until deported if they are members or have raised funds for or have provided some kind of material support to an organization designated by the Secretary of State as a terrorist organization. It allows non-citizens to be ordered and deported, and if no country will take them, they can remain in the United States detained indefinitely. Individuals believed to be members of foreign terrorist organizations or of any group publicly endorses terrorist acts, as well as their spouse, children, or anybody else may be denied entry into the United States under this act without any proof. Just very quickly, I'm going to run through one or two more things that this bill does. It's a little bit scary. Law enforcement no longer has to prove through probable cause that they need a search warrant. Instead of knocking at your door and saying we have a search warrant and want to come in and search A, B, and C, they can come in and do that. They can surveil your computer and your telephone without access or without telling you. They can have access to things that I call our really personal files, those files we don't discuss with anybody else. We barely get the words out to our husband or spouses or significant others. Things like what our educational background was, all those nitty-gritty details, our medical and financial and mental health and other personal records are completely open. And all of this is deemed is if the Secretary of State deems he needs this information. Americans engaging in civil disobedience or other form of protest activity can be charged with domestic terrorism. And this act expands the range of computer crimes defined as terrorist offenses and penalties attached to them. I just want to make a quick reference before we continue on about what's happening in Hartford ourselves. There was a piece of legislation that expanded wiretapping. There was a piece of legislation put out to allow a state crime of terrorism with an incredibly broad definition attached to it. We have seen legislation to introduce, as I mentioned before, the Pledge of Allegiance and In God We Trust. We have seen a Homeland Security bill that goes so far as to wrap up the fact that they will tell you when you need to be vaccinated. You have no option about whether you want to be or whether your children will be and what the quarantine efforts will be after that happens. These are bills that we're seeing on a statewide level that are being followed through on a national level. I'm getting the high five sign, and I have left in the back a fact sheet that's called the USA Patriot Bill fact sheet, and we encourage you all to please pick up that fact sheet, and when we open the floor for conversation and questions, I welcome conversation and questions. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker, Dr. Mazen Kumsia, is Associate Professor of Genetics and Director of Cytogenetic Services at Yale University School of Medicine. He is founder and president of the Holy Land Conservation Foundation and ex-president of Middle East Genetics Association. He won the Jallo Activism Award from the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee in 1998. He is co-founder of Triangle Middle East Dialogue and the Carolina Middle East Association and served on the board of the ADC North Carolina chapter. He is co-founder and currently treasurer of Al-Ada, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition. His activities most recently include work on the Right to Return campaign and coalition building in Connecticut and beyond. In Connecticut, he volunteers with a local group of activists, including Middle East Crisis Committee, Al-Ada Connecticut Chapter, and Connecticut Peace Coalition.
Thank you for having me. I want to just start by giving you a few glimpses of some things that happened and experiences that I know about of colleagues and friends of mine, and then ask you to think of the commonality of these things that you hear. A friend of mine named Dua El Masri in North Carolina got on the airplane, and he was talking to the guy next to him, who started the conversation, actually. And he told him he was from Lebanon, and then the guy asked him, well, what do you think about things? And he said, well, you know, I think the U.S. foreign policy is not that great. I condemn terrorism, but I think U.S. foreign policy is not good. And the guy stood up, walked over to the pilot, told him there is a terrorist on board and you need to get rid of him. And pilot came back and talked to Wael and said, we don't want you on this airplane. And they got him off the airplane and, you know, they didn't accuse him of anything. They just didn't like him. And so they basically had him get on the next airplane. Treated him nicely after about 3 hours of interrogations. And put him on a first class in the next airplane, but he was late, obviously, for going where he wanted to go. another colleague of mine, an Israeli Jewish person, actually, who got her name is Liad, and was on a bus and wearing a Palestinian kafia, you know, the Arabic Palestinian dress around her neck, and. And the bus driver was not happy, and he came and asked her to take it off. And she said, no, I'm not going to take it off. It's just part of my dress. I like to dress this way. And he said, no, you've got to take it off or you get off the bus. And she refused and, you know, started argument with him and so forth. The bus passengers folded into three groups. One group who supported the bus driver, one group who just simply moved away from the scene of the confrontation, and one group who simply, tried to intervene and tell the guy, you know, she's just wearing a cloth. You know, what's the big deal? And she's willing to show her ID that she's Jewish, she's not Palestinian, she's not wearing bombs here, you can search me, whatever. No, that's not acceptable. Here in Connecticut, a brick was thrown through a windshield of a grocery store for a Palestinian, an Arab, not a Palestinian, store owner. He's from Egypt, I believe. A friend of mine, his name is Muhammad, has two children at school. One of them is in sixth grade. And then the sixth grade teacher came to the class after the September 11 attack and right in front of all the other kids, she pointed the finger. You terrorists, you people, you Palestinians are terrorists. And I could go on and on with tons of other examples, including my own experiences, but you don't want to hear that. But I want you to think carefully about what is the common thread in all of this. What is the common thread? The common thread, in my view, is this idea of duality that we people sometimes, including us and each one of us, really have to look in the mirror very carefully about when we approach these in terms of thinking, not in terms of humanity and us, but in terms of trying to think of a duality, us versus them. You know, well, who is them? You know, who, you know, when they people come to me on the street and say, well, you know, because your accent is different, you're not true American. Well, you know, what is American? What is, you know, who are you to be telling me that I'm not an American? You know, where did you come from? You know, and so it's really, to me, it's this issue of duality, of thinking of us versus them that's very disturbing. And this actually, you might think of it as benign things. Sometimes the incidents are very benign. But in reality, you know, you think of how Germany started down the road of the Holocaust and all this stuff. It started very benign, us versus them. You know, we Germans, we Aryan people. You know, look what they are doing to us. They destroyed our economy. They. Who is they? Then we start pointing fingers at a few other people. And then we started adding those things. And that's the problem, I think. That's down the road for racism. It's down the road for doing atrocities much, much more than simply telling people to get off the airplane and stuff like that. And I would ask us to be very, very careful about what we do here. It is obviously disturbing for us as Arab Americans to hear that, for example, 40 or 50%, I don't know the exact number, of Americans support that Arab Americans should carry special IDs, you know. Think about this for a minute. You know, what's the difference between that and wearing a yellow Star of David on your... it's Israelis now, when they arrested 1,500 people, all men ages 15 to 44 in the refugee camps that they invaded, they drowned all the men and they started putting numbers on their hands, you know, on their arms. Does this remind you of something? You know, we really need to start thinking about what is it that we're doing nationally. And I don't want to take too much time. I'd rather leave things for question. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Attorney Olinda Morales. Olinda Morales is a lawyer with the Connecticut Department of Public Health and a pro bono attorney with the International Institute of Connecticut, where she represents low-income asylum applicants before the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the Immigration Court, and with the University of Connecticut Tax Clinic, where she represents low-income taxpayers in federal and state tax disputes before the Internal Revenue Service and the United States Tax Court.
Mr. Godin. Hi, everyone. The tragedy of September 11 has gone far beyond of the horror that occurred on that day. It left a legacy of fear, fear that has become part of the American landscape. It's our reality now. First, the sense of security that the public once felt may never exist again. We now fear future bombing, biological and chemical weapons, and attacks unexpected. Yet another segment of the population fears something else. We fear to be singled out because of our name, religion, ethnicity, the way we look. One example of this is that we now have the largest number of name changes that we have never seen before. Unfortunately, for some of us, we have such distinct racial characteristics and accents, as you can hear, that we cannot change. Or maybe we don't wish to change. Before I speak to you about the Patriot Act, I would like to point out that before such an act, which took effect on October 25, 2000, everyone in the United States had constitutional rights, to some degree. Aliens present in the United States, or I should say, documented and undocumented people who are not American citizens, had constitutional rights as well. They were protected by the Constitution, substantially enjoying the rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, as Teresa Younger just told you. Specifically, the 4th Amendment affords people the right to be secure from searches in their houses, their papers and effects against unreasonable searches, which means that the government cannot seize you or detain you without a warrant, a properly issued warrant. And no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause. The 5th Amendment provides that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, and property without the due process of law. At the heart of this freedom from government custody, detention, or other form of physical restraint. Well, these rights have changed. Documented and undocumented people who are not American citizens have lost this right, not only to the Patriot Act, but also through a piece of legislature that has to do with Immigration and Naturalization Service. It's the amended 8 CFR 287.3 Section D. The old version of this rule allowed INS to make warrantless arrests where the INS officer had reason to believe that the alien so arrested is in the United States in violation of any such law or regulation and is likely to escape before a warrant can be obtained for his or her arrest. The amended regulation, however, repeals the requirement that the INS bring the arrestee in front of a proper examining officer or authority within 24 hours, and it changes for 48 hours. Also, the amended rule provides that in the event of an emergency or other extraordinary circumstances, the INS have indefinite time to hold that person in prison. The INS can do this indefinite detention even when they don't have a prima facie evidence of any violations of the INS laws. The Patriot Act. On October 25, 2001, the U.S. Congress enacted the Patriot Act. Among its various provisions, as you heard earlier, the Act grants the Attorney General the power to detain any non-citizen who is certified as a spy. While the constitutionality of the Act is questionable, it unequivocally limits the Attorney General's power to detain such individual for a period of 7 days. Unless that person has been charged with a crime or offense or has been placed in removal proceedings. The removal proceeding is nothing more than deportation. If neither immigration proceedings nor criminal charges have been brought against the alien, in quotations, before the seventh-day deadline, the statute requires that the AG release the individual. This is awkward, isn't it? I just told you that the INS has unlimited discretion to detain an undocumented or documented person indefinitely. Thus, the combination of the amended regulation and the Patriot Act creates an inexplicable and strange situation where the Attorney General may only detain an individual for 7 days unless that person is certified as a spy or terrorist, or the Attorney General has to order his or her release. And yet, the INS amended regulation that I just talked to you about says that the INS officer can detain a person without his due process rights for an indefinite period of time. For those of us who had studied the Constitution at some length, we know that the amended regulation is superseded by the Patriot Act. However, we are yet to see how the courts will resolve that discrepancy. Unfortunately, what the amended regulations has also done is that it has done exactly what the Supreme Court has said before that is unconstitutional. The amended regulation is broad, is vague, and it gives unlimited discretion to the government. The Supreme Court of the United States has said over and over again that such laws are unconstitutional and they will not be upheld. I believe that once a case is brought in front of the Supreme Court of the United States, they will deem part of the Patriot Act as well as the mentioned regulation as unconstitutional. However, it's going to take a long time and a lot of people are going to be hurt. We already have at least 1,100 non-citizens in jail who have been robbed of their constitutional rights. Thank you.
You are listening to a panel discussion on civil liberties following the September 11th calamity. The event took place in Willimantic, Connecticut on March 21st, 2002.
Our next speaker is attorney Rafael Rodriguez. Rafael Rodriguez is a poverty lawyer in Hartford and has been involved in the struggle for Vieques for 20 years. In May 2000, he was arrested and later convicted for trespassing in Vieques. He is also a freelance journalist for progressive newspapers in Puerto Rico and Hartford.
I think it's interesting of the new times that we're living in this country, something that happened to me the other day. I go to the gym every morning, and I ride a bike. You know, they have a whole bunch of TV sets, and there are people exercising and watching the TV sets. And they usually put it in headline news. So I ride my bike for about 45 minutes, and they keep repeating this same thing in headline news every 8 minutes. The same thing, the same thing. They're talking about the same thing. So I got off the bike, and I decided to change the channel. And it was amazing how I almost created a riot because people were really angry at the fact that I had changed a TV where they were seeing the same thing that kept repeating every 8 minutes, same thing. And I think that that's part of the interesting culture that we're living right now. My first reaction today is I think I want to commend the organizers of this activity for bringing together a number of people here, particularly of a minority background, to talk about the issue of civil rights and liberty in the United States. I think that instead of being watching headline news over and over, we should use these opportunities to start a dialogue between People in mainstream America, Anglos and people who live in the suburbs who really love peace, and minority populations. And in this panel, we have a number of minority people. And I say that because the reality of it is that many people don't realize that terrorism for most minorities in this country didn't start in September 11. If you look at the history of minorities in the United States, if you look at slavery, what happened after slavery, segregation, the struggles in the South, if you look at the conditions that many immigrants from Mexico go through on a daily scenario, they fit the definition of terrorism. Terrorism didn't start September 11. I want to personalize this a little bit. My reaction, you know, we all remember where we were in September 11. My first reaction when I saw that is, you know, what's happening? I mean, a lot of people are dying. And as a peace-loving person, I felt hurt. But on the other hand, as a minority, I started thinking, but wait a second. I do understand why people are reacting to this, and why many Americans and people, Anglos, are feeling so hurt and so angry about this. But maybe it's because this is the first time that they feel it themselves. They don't realize that we have gone through that for years and years. Prior to Puerto Rico, and I'm originally from Puerto Rico, becoming part of the United States, there was something in San Juan where the city was bombed by the U.S. Navy. And we had no relationship whatsoever with the United States. They went on ships, they started bombing, 100 or so people died. That was the first act of terrorism against our people, 1898, I think it was in May. So when my reaction with the September 11th thing was, you know, how to understand this from the perspective of a minority, from the perspective of someone who a year before was in Vieques, was arrested by the U.S. Navy. Probably some of you are familiar with the situation in Vieques that will fit the definition of terrorism, where people are dying of cancer, where people are being mistreated, where a number of people have been killed by the U.S. Navy without any consequences to them. So I had this thing that was like tearing me apart. And one of the things that I decided is I went to my home and I started reading Henry David Thoreau. After finishing that, I read Martin Luther King. And I started reading about experiences in the United States, particularly minorities who have suffered so much, and yet they have responded with a peaceful alternative to violence. And I think that it is time that we use this opportunity to start a dialogue with the people who have suffered terrorism in the United States, and for mainstream America to see how many of us have reacted, not by thinking in terms of revenge, not by thinking in terms of simply acting in a military and violent form, but instead acting in the form of a non-violent civil disobedience. I'm here today to talk about Vieques, and Vieques is connected with that. In the last 2 years, Vieques has been probably the most successful non-violent civil disobedient movement in the United States that is going on, where a number of people have decided that in order to free themselves from a situation which in many ways, like I mentioned, it has aspects of terrorism, where people are dying of cancer, where children are suffering differing illnesses, where people are being precluded from having a normal life, and they live pretty much in a concentration camp. Instead of reacting in terms of violence, instead of thinking in terms of destruction, what this humble, poor island near Puerto Rico has decided is to use civil disobedience as a way of confronting violence. And I think that's an example that we have to think about, and that mainstream America has to think about. People who have suffered for 60 years in that way, how come they come with an alternative of peace and not of violence? In terms of the impact of the Patriotic Act in the situation of Vieques and minorities. I want to make a distinction. I think we have to start thinking and talking in terms of a new legal regime in the United States. One thing is the Patriotic Act that was approved by Congress. But there has been other measures that were taken and have been taken by other departments or other sections of the government. There have been executive orders providing for military tribunals. That's not part of the Patriotic Act, although people sometimes think that they're all together. There are a number of administrative decisions that have been taken by the Secretary of Justice concerning client-attorney privileges, other concerning the detention of immigrants and how much time they're going to be detained. And they're all interconnected, and they all affect in many ways the culture that we're living right now, which is I would consider to be a new legal regime. One important component of that is that we have a Supreme Court that is quite similar to the Supreme Court that we have in 1856 with the Dred Scott case, which was a Supreme Court that was for all matters a hijacked by the most reactionary sectors of the United States, pro-slavery, together with the people who were benefiting from slavery in the North. And the Supreme Court became an instrument of limiting civil rights. It became an instrument of justifying and allowing slavery to survive in the United States. We have a Supreme Court now that in some ways we can make an analogy. Most people are not even following many of the decisions that the Supreme Court has been taking in the last few weeks after September 11. Decisions concerning the American with Disability Act. Right now, there's a case before the Supreme Court which could have a significant impact on the rights of workers in the workplace, disabled workers. And the case is called, it's interesting, it's called Echeval v. Chevron. Echeval is a Spanish name, and Chevron, we all know who Chevron is. And one of the sectors one person who has taken a personal stake in this case is President Bush, because he really is supporting the position of Chevron. Again, we have a new situation in the United States. It's not only executive. We have the Congress. We have a Supreme Court acting in a way combined to suppress fundamental legal rights in the United States. And we also have to say that they are acting in alliance with the press. It's shameful the way in which most of the media in the United States has reacted in the last few months after September 11. It's shameful the fact that they don't report many things that affect your rights. How many of you are aware of cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court in the last few weeks concerning the rights of police to detain you for frisking you and for a minor traffic violation? The press doesn't tell you that. But they're acting in cohort. We have a unique situation in the United States where I will say that it has created a climate of intimidation. And that's what you saw in the gym. And the devil sometimes lies in detail. But if you go to airports, if you go to different places in the United States, you see people afraid of expressing their views. You see people for the first time afraid of making jokes. You feel people afraid of asserting their rights. The case of Vieques is extreme. After September 11, what the Navy has done in Vieques is together with the federal court in Puerto Rico and together with the FBI, has been to create a climate of intimidation. It's a climate of zero tolerance for social protests. Right now, the Navy is talking about starting bombing in Vieques in April 1st, coming weeks. And one of the things that they did is immediately after September 11, they declared Vieques, where nothing is happening, a zone of a high alert. And interestingly, if you go to Vieques, of course, the media is not going to tell you that. The first thing that they did is they put machine guns pointing to the people. So you have people who for 60 years have been abused by the Navy, people who last year I was arrested with them. They did all kind of things to us. They threw a pepper spray, all kind of stuff. We remain simply in a civil disobedience stand. We were put in jail with people who have no history of violently reacting to the barbarism that the Navy is doing in Vieques. And yet the first thing that they did was pointing machine guns to people who for 60 years have been oppressed by the Navy. That climate of intimidation in Vieques is connected with the fact that we have social protests and we have a civil disobedience movement in Vieques in the last 2 years. But what they have created for the United States is, and you can have my word for this, is that if there's a situation of protest for whatever significant reason in this country, they have created the mechanism to create a climate of intimidation and repression that has not been seen in this country for many years. People are thinking, well, you know, nothing is happening here. Well, the future could be telling as to what would be the impact of these measures. If there's any question, I can talk about that after. Thank you.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.